This is day five of this October 2017 seven-day session. We'll return to the teachings of 12th century Chan Master Da Hui. And this is from the book Swampland Flowers, which is translated by Christopher Cleary. I think many of you know that the Cleary brothers, Christopher and Thomas, have done a lot of books, translated a lot of books. I noticed here for the first time in the acknowledgement of this book, he says, I could never have read Da Hui's words or undertaken to translate them without the encouragement and guidance of my brother, Thomas Cleary. Picking up here in one of the letters, he apparently is addressing a so-called gentleman of affairs. It's never spelled out what that means, but a householder, someone with responsible job. He says, gentlemen of affairs make their living within the confines of thought and judgment their whole lives. As soon as they hear someone of knowledge speak of the Dharma, in which there is nothing to attain, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. Someone of knowledge, I think he means someone of wisdom. As soon as they hear someone of wisdom, let's say a teacher, speak of the Dharma in which there is nothing to attain. We say this in the Prajnaparamita, the Heart Sutra, not even wisdom to attain. Attainment too is emptiness. How so? Because each one of us is the Dharma. How can we attain what we are and have always been? We use the word Buddha nature fairly often, but really a synonym of that would be Dharma nature. So he says when people, worldly people, hear this talk of the Dharma, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. Well, this fear of falling into emptiness is probably the primal human fear, if we think of it also as a fear of dying. The irony is that none of us knows what it is to die. Speaking here as meaning to die in the conventional sense, die in our deathbed, but it is the most widely feared thing in the world. Fear of death. But I think it just means fear of disappearing. Fear of falling into emptiness. Fearing of dissolving. But what is it? What does that mean? It's a fear of the self disappearing. I hate to break it to everyone, but that's what we're doing in this week. We are striving to disappear. Why would we fear that? Well, because we're so attached to the self. Because of a lifetime and lifetimes lifetimes, plural, if you will. Because of that, we cling to the self, of the, which is really clinging to an idea or a picture. It's an abstraction. For many people, it's the only thing they know is the world of self and other. What else could there be? That's like falling off the edge of the world. And then he says, whenever I see someone talking like this, I immediately ask him, is this one who fears falling into emptiness himself empty or not? This is a Chinese style of putting in question form what his point is. He's saying, we ourselves are empty. This is our Dharma nature, our Buddha nature. This no self. He says, when he asks someone this, 10 out of 10 cannot explain. Since you have always taken thought and judgment as your nesting place, as soon as you hear it said that you shouldn't think, immediately you're at a loss and can't find your grip. You've always taken thought and judgment as your nesting place. Now, thought, yes, naturally. Judgment is another one. It's one of the things I hear most often from people who, at their first or second sesshin, is how much they judge people. It's another one of these things that is more or less unconscious to us because we do it so reflexively all the time. And we do it to ourselves, of course. I think there's something about our Judeo-Christian culture that invites judgments and judging others and oneself. And it's probably reflected in the tendency that we, as Americans at least, the tendency we have to find fault with ourselves. It's a very painful way to go through life, judging oneself and, yes, judging others. And we see when the mind settles in sesshin, we see how unnecessary it is. Why do we do this? Why are we always imposing our judgments on ourselves and others? Since you've always taken thought and judgment as your nesting place, as soon as you hear it said that you shouldn't think, you're at a loss. And you're far from realizing that this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life. Which just means let go of the I and the me and the my. Hard to do. Luckily, we don't have to just let go. We have a practice to turn to, and the practice does the letting go for us. The phrase "let go" is a little misleading in that respect, because we don't need to let go. We don't need to get away from something We just need to go into our practice. That's not quite as hard to throw ourselves with full concentration into our practice. And that's how we detach from thoughts. He says, if correct mindfulness is present at all times, and the attitude of fear for birth and death doesn't waver, then over long days and months, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar, and what was stale will naturally become fresh. What is the stale? It's the brilliance and cleverness, that which thinks and judges. Again, here he's tailoring this this letter to this recipient who he must know gets caught in his head. What is the unfamiliar? It is enlightenment, nirvana, true thusness, Buddha nature, where there's no thought or discrimination, where figuring and calculating cannot reach, where there's no way for you to use your mental arrangements. So this is why this journey we're on is so daunting, because we have to keep going into the unfamiliar, the unknown. The Vikings or Christopher Columbus just forging out into what they didn't know. They had to find out. We often think of that as courage, and it is. Surely it is great courage. But we could also see it as a great need to know that cannot be denied. They couldn't deny it. They had to, even aware of the risks. And this is what we're doing here. We're groping our way off the edge of the world of thoughts into this darkness of not knowing. Meister Eckhart said, if you wish to know the road you tread on, you must close your eyes and walk in the dark. And in Zen, there is the saying, proceed toward the obscure and unknown through the obscure and unknown. On this ship that we call mu, breath. What am I? Who am I? What is it? That's our raft to take us to the other shore. Here's another letter to a Tongzhu Li. When people engaged in meditation read the sutras and the stories of the circumstances in which the ancient worthies entered the path, okay, that would mean the enlightenment accounts of the masters. Maybe he also means the koans. They should just empty their minds. Don't look for the original marvel or seek enlightenment in sounds, names, and verbal meanings. In other words, don't read these things with expectations or ideas. If you take this attitude, you're obstructing your own correct wisdom and perception, and you'll never have an entry. Panchan, don't know who that is, someone formidable, no doubt. Panchan said, it's like hurling a sword at the sky. No talk of whether it reaches or not. Yeah, and that too is what we're doing. Don't be careless, Dawei adds. Like hurling a sword at the sky. Just doing it. Throwing one's heart into it with no guarantee of success. Except that as we go on, we see that we are succeeding even when we don't reach the sky. It's in the exertion. It's in the effort. We don't have to worry about the rest. Again, he returns to the familiar and the unfamiliar. In general, since time without beginning, you have overdone the familiar and left undone the unfamiliar. Even though you may see through it all for a moment, in the end, your power in the path cannot overcome the power of your acts or karma. So consider that. Even though you may see through it all for a moment, we get glimpses of this freedom of no thought. In the end, he's saying to this student of his, your power in the path cannot overcome the power of your karma. And what is the power of karma? It is what's familiar and stale. And what is the power of the path? It is what's unfamiliar and fresh. Basically, however, there is no fixed measure to, quote, the power of the path and, quote, the power of karma. Just observe whether or not you are befuddled in the conduct of your daily activities. When you becloud the power of the path, then it is overcome by the power of karma. When the power of karma prevails, then you get stuck wherever you go. When you get stuck wherever you go, then you become attached everywhere. When you get attached everywhere, you consider misery to be happiness. When I read that last clause, you consider misery to be happiness, I think of how people accommodate to their thoughts. Their thoughts, even though the thoughts can cause them so much misery. We bedevil ourselves with our thoughts, our ruminating and worrying and rehashing in the mind unpleasant things. Not to mention just the overall tendency toward self-judgments, finding fault with ourselves, self-criticism. It just makes us miserable. Why do we cling to thoughts then? Because it's the known and familiar. Because we've done it so long. And that's another word for karma, is habit force. We're habituated to the thoughts. This is really the task before us, is to outgrow our karmic tendencies. If we think of it as a project, then it's daunting. How can we do this? We see the same things come up over and over, sesshin after sesshin, year after year. I know from giving doksan for so long that many people find that they're caught in certain patterns. Some of this comes out in sesshin. People will say, okay, day five, in the past, I always have this thing come up on day five. Self-doubt, or a certain kind of frenetic energy that overtakes one, or the opposite, kind of losing heart. And it can be so discouraging to see these things come with kind of diabolical regularity, predictability. But there, I always say, please try to understand that these are conditioned phenomena, these patterns, these recurrences. What that means is they're phenomena that are based on conditions, and conditions are always changing. Yes, they're not, maybe often not changing as fast as we'd like them to, but they're basically change itself. Conditions are flux. There's nothing solid, nothing substantial, there's nothing permanent in conditions. Conditions are wind and water. So no matter how stubborn these patterns are that we keep finding in our face, there's nothing permanent to them. They will eventually yield to persistent zazen. We can't really squawk about how stubborn they are when what has formed them, what has formed these patterns, is our insistence on reacting to people and situations in the same way over and over millions and billions of times. We've chosen these patterns. We've chosen through where our decision of where to direct our attention. Well, here we are to change that, to find new choices when confronted with our thoughts, that we don't have to just go along with them. We can turn away from them to this realm of no thought. And that's what each practice is leading us to. Whatever our particular practice is, it's leading us into the realm of no thought. And that is our liberation. You consider misery to be happiness just only because it's become, it seems to be safe. We've done it so often. Okay, we haven't died. We're still here. So, yeah, let's stick to what we know. Even though it just perpetuates our dissatisfaction. I'm skipping here around some. If you want to cut directly through, don't entertain doubts about Buddhas and patriarchs or doubts about birth and death. Just always let go and make your heart empty and open. Again, this let go. It's hard to just let go. But we don't need to. We just need to trust the practice we're working on. That's our go-to place. Not let go, but go-to. It's our refuge, this practice. And it'll clean things up for us. He says, when things come up, then deal with them according to the occasion. Be like the stillness of water, like the clarity of a mirror, so that whether good or bad, beautiful or ugly approach, you don't make the slightest move to avoid them. Then you will truly know that the mindless world of spontaneity is inconceivable. Mindless is unfortunate translation. Has this negative connotation to it. No-minded world, this world of no-mindedness, no thought, is inconceivable. Inconceivable because it's without concepts. It's not accessible through ideas and concepts, thoughts and words. Here he is writing to another man of letters, identified only as Secretary Liu. Since we parted, I don't know whether or not you can avoid being carried away by external objects in your daily activities as you respond to circumstances, whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them. Let's repeat that. Whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them. So looking through them no-mindedly, looking through them without putting them aside. whether or not you can act freely when you meet with people, whether or not you engage in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet, whether or not you are thoroughly investigating this matter without any distracted thoughts. In other words, are you saying? Are you doing all this? Are you engaging in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet? How rare that is in silence, in moments of idleness, not to engage in vain thinking. If you think of vain thinking as anything about the self or the my, and he quotes the Buddha, he says, "Old Yellowface has said, when the mind does not vainly grasp at past things, does not long for things in the future, and does not dwell on anything in the present, then you realize fully that the three times are all empty and still." You shouldn't think about past events, whether good or bad. If you think, that obstructs the path. You shouldn't consider future events. To consider them is crazy confusion. Present events are right in front of you. Whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, don't fix your mind on them. That is, don't become attached to them. Don't spin them into thoughts, these present events. If you do fix your mind on them, it will disturb your heart. Just take everything in its time, responding according to circumstances, and you will naturally accord with this principle, with the way. So much of this work is just noticing when your mind is in the past or when it's in the future or in fantasies. The key word being noticing. Because then we can turn back to just this. He says, unpleasant situations are easy to handle, pleasant situations are hard to handle. Okay, let's hear what he says about that. For that which goes against one's will, it boils down to one word, patience. Settle down and reflect a moment, and in a little while, it's gone. It's pleasant situations that truly give you no way to escape, like pairing magnet and iron. Unconsciously, this and that come together in one place. So these are things that we get stuck to because they please us or they give us pleasure. Even inanimate objects are thus. How much the more so for those acting in ignorance with their whole beings making a living within it. In this world, if you have no wisdom, you will be dragged unknowing and unawares by that ignorance into a net. Once inside the net, won't it be difficult to look for a way out? So we get enmeshed in our pleasures. I remember Roshi Kaplow's autobiographical account in the book Zen Merging of East and West, I think it was there, he said that, you know, just before getting into practice, he had grown weary of the joyless pursuit of pleasure. doesn't have to be pain in the ordinary sense, in the conventional sense, that brings us to practice. It's the way that even pleasure can become tedious and disappointing. Then he wraps up this letter by saying, "What I've been talking about thus far is all my personal life experience. Even right now, I practice just like this. I hope that you will take advantage of your physical strength and health and also enter this stable equilibrium." Takes this unusual type of person to relate to this last, take advantage of your physical strength and health. Because when you have physical strength and health, you just tend to take it for granted. It takes a little imagination to project into the future and realize that you won't always have it. Another letter. "Having read your letter carefully, I have come to know that you are unremitting in your conduct, that you are not carried away by the press of official duties." And by the way, he knows that what the letter writer is reporting may not be true. And people tend to exaggerate how well they're doing in their practice, or exaggerate how much they're sitting. So he's aware that this guy may be embellishing his how much he practices and all, but he's taking it for now at face value. "I've come to know that you're unremitting in your conduct, that you are not carried away by the press of official duties, that in the midst of swift flowing streams you vigorously examine yourself." He may hear also, Da Wei may be reminding him, "Yeah, this is what you should be doing, by the way." "Far from being lax, your aspiration to the path grows ever more firm as time goes on. You have fulfilled my humble wishes solidly and profoundly." Mm-hmm. So is that the end of the letter? No. And the next paragraph begins, "Nevertheless, worldly passions are like a blazing fire. When will they ever end? Right in the midst of the hubbub, you mustn't forget the business of the bamboo chair and reed cushion. Usually, to meditate, you set your mind on a still concentration point, but you must be able to use it right in the midst of daily life. If you have no strength amidst commotion, after all, it's as if you never made any effort in stillness." This business of the bamboo chair and the reed cushion, at least one of the Chinese monasteries we visited, we found, yes, that the chair is made of bamboo. That's more of a kind of a stool they sat on, and then a cushion made of reeds. That seems to square with what I remember. We get an experience. We have some experience of what he's talking about. This able to use our practice in the midst of hubbub and the turbulence of daily life, busy daily life, we get a sense of that right after Sesshin, where we have this wind to our back when we come out of Sesshin, and we can find ourselves even in complicated situations and, yes, commotion, noise and all, that there's this eye of the hurricane within us. And that means it's always there. We just have to learn to access it more in our daily life. And how do we do that? Of course, through sitting. We discover after Sesshin that even if we don't sit the Sesshin schedule in our daily life, some extra sitting is going to make a difference. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. I think many people make this mistake. They just sort of slump their shoulders after Sesshin. Okay, well, here we are, back to the same old thing. I wish I could be in Sesshin all the time. But it doesn't have to be all or nothing. Try ramping up your sitting, doing more of it. You'll see a difference. In the ends, if you consider quietude right and commotion wrong, then this is seeking the real aspect by destroying the worldly aspect, seeking nirvana, the peace of extinction, apart from birth and death, that is, apart from samsara, daily life. When you like the quiet and hate the hubbub, this is just the time to apply effort. Suddenly, when in the midst of hubbub, you topple the scene of quietude, that power surpasses the meditation seat and cushion by a million billion times. So in this respect, he's exactly like his one of his Dharma heirs by several centuries, Hakuin. Hakuin made the same point that the power of keeping the mind centered, grounded, and concentrated in daily life, worldly life, is so much greater than the power it takes to concentrate while sitting. We need them both. The only chance we stand of having this kind of centeredness in daily life is through daily sitting. All right, time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to the root Dharma gate beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure, I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I bow to attain.